one has to assume, especially while the defense secretary is visiting Israel, because it would be hugely embarrassing. So the assumption has to be that the U.S. knew this attack was going to take place and did not say not to do it. Otherwise, there would have to be some kind of a protest by the United States to the Israeli government for doing it.
The attack on Natanz nuclear facility is not the first act of terror by the Israeli regime against the Islamic Republic. A blast hit a centrifuge assembly line at Natanz July last year, which Iran described as an act of sabotage. Head of the Israeli agency Yossi Cohen told the New York Times then that Israel had detonated a bomb there. In November 2020, prominent nuclear physicist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in a terrorist attack near the Iranian capital Tehran. This, as his name was mentioned multiple times in a presentation in 2018 by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during which he repeated baseless claims about the Iranian nuclear energy program. Netanyahu described the scientist as a director of Iran's nuclear program and threatened, quote, remember that name, Fakhrizadeh. Apart from Fakhrizadeh, a number of other Iranian scientists have fallen victim to the Israeli terrorism. Ardashir Hosseinpour, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Daryush Rezai Nejad, Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan are all on that list. But as far as the Natanz attack is concerned, it came a day after Iran started off several cascades of advanced centrifuges in the facility. The incident also comes at a time when Tehran is holding talks with the remaining signatories to the Iran nuclear deal in the Austrian capital Vienna. The negotiations are aimed at removing the U.S. sanctions on the Islamic Republic.
Well, for Israel to do it at this time, the assumption, again, would be that they're trying to mess up those negotiations and make it hard for the United States to come to an agreement with Iran. You know, it'll be harder for the U.S., I imagine, to go back by taking off the sanctions.
All in all, what is almost certain is the fact that Israel will leave no stone unturned to hamper Iran's nuclear advancements by carrying out such acts of terrorism. The regime also tries its best to prevent the United States from reaching a deal with the Islamic Republic to remove the sanctions that have crippled the lives of millions of Iranians. But many are also pointing the finger at the U.S. in the case of the Natanz Sabotage Act and other terrorist attacks by the Israeli regime, arguing Israel doesn't commit such acts of terror without Washington's blessing.
A group of activists in the U.S. has held rallies in Washington, D.C. to call for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen. The activists from the Yemeni Liberation Movement have been on hunger strike since March 29th to call on the U.S. government to cease support for Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and draw attention to the plight of millions of Yemenis facing malnutrition and starvation. The protesters say what they're going through doesn't compare with the pain experienced by war-weary Yemenis, but it can raise awareness about the dire humanitarian situation in the Arab nation.
So, as someone who's part of Yemeni Liberation Movement, we believe in self-determination. So for the people of Yemen to determine for themselves the way that they want to live. And they're not able right now to make those decisions because they're actively and violently being starved by the U.S. government and by the Saudi-UAE coalition.
Experts say the fact that a growing number of people in the U.S., including politicians, are now demanding an end to the years-long war is a positive development, but not enough to end the conflict.
Everybody can imagine just how much your health and well-being is impacted. And I do hope that those who are watching and seeing realize that the longer that you all are on a hunger strike, the longer that there are people actually dying in Yemen.
But what steps can the international community take to ensure it can put an end to the deadly crisis? During his first foreign policy speech, U.S. President Joe Biden laid out his agenda for the Yemen conflict.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The announcement raised hopes that the Saudi hostilities against Yemen would end soon. But even that couldn't stop Saudis from keeping up their onslaught on the war-ravaged country. Although the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen escalated under former U.S. President Donald Trump with his administration's boundless support for the Saudis, the war began when Joe Biden was incumbent as a U.S. vice president in the Barack Obama administration.
I mean, I think Biden's silence speaks volumes, right? So since 2015, an administration that he was a part of, he's actively chosen billions and billions of dollars in weapon sales. Corporations have made billions and billions of dollars in sales, and they've decided that that money, right, is more important than the lives of Yemeni people. And it's more important than the child that dies every 75 seconds in Yemen.
Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and its other regional allies, launched a devastating military campaign on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Riyadh-backed former president Abdrabbo Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the National Salvation Government. That goal has not been fulfilled thanks to the resistance put up by Ansarullah throughout 6 years of indiscriminate war and blockade. What Saudi Arabia's soon to be a short conflict turned to an all-out war, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions. Many observers believe that ending the war requires international pressure against Saudi Arabia and its regional allies, especially by their powerful partners, including the United States. But whether or not those nations' wider West Asia policies allow risking their ties with Riyadh is anybody's guess.
Proper Nutrition with Brother Sayyid Vahid Alavi in the program The Month of Allah.
Assalamu alaikum everyone, and welcome back to the month of Allah. In the last program, we tried to answer the question, how to eat. And we answered it, but I'm going to go through it one more time in this program. In this program, we're going to talk about another question. And that is, how many meals a day does Islam recommend us to eat? How many meals should we eat during the day? I will mention some narrations about the meals. In one narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, eat breakfast and dinner and do not eat anything between those two, because it causes the destruction of the body. Have you not heard, the Imam is referring to a verse of the Noble Quran, he says, have you not heard that the Lord says, and they, the dwellers of paradise, have their special sustenance in the mornings and in the evenings. From another narration of Imam Ridha alayhi salam, he says that a person should eat twice a day, once in the beginning of the day and once in the beginning of the evening. In another narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, which was addressed to a person who complained of stomach pain, the Imam tells him, eat only at the beginning of the day and at the beginning of the night. Therefore, in contrast of the habit that we have, that we eat lunch, you know, we eat lunch. Everyone eats lunch. You go after your work and eat lunch with your colleagues. You eat lunch in school. You eat lunch in the university and so on and so forth. The narrations say that you should not eat lunch and eat breakfast and dinner. So what is concluded from the narrations is that a Muslim, if a Muslim wants to follow the Muslim lifestyle, should eat twice a day, in the morning and in the evening, and jump over the lunch. But what should a person do if, for example, I feel hunger between those two meals. What should I do then? Well, the recommendation is that you should eat fruits and eat a lot of it. And that is something that we can do during Ramadan too. In the holy month of Ramadan, instead of eating breakfast and dinner, what do? We eat sahari and iftar. And iftar means break fast or breaking the fast. And sahari means to keep vigil or to wake. And that means to wake up early so you will be able to eat. And that again is recommended twice a day, your sahari and your iftari. What we can conclude from these narrations is that appetite and hunger are linked together. And the human well-being is linked to those two, that you should feel appetite and you should feel hunger when you want to eat. And still feel a small appetite is left, but you stop eating there. So the human well-being is in those two key factors. Imam Ali alayhi salam tells his son, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, four recommendations that if you do not want to visit a doctor, if you don't want to feel any need for a doctor, you should follow those four recommendations. Number one, to feel truly hunger and then, and only then, start eating. So feel hunger when you want to eat. Number two, to stop eating when you still have some appetite left. Number three, do not swallow until the food is thoroughly chewed. And number four, to visit the toilet and relieve yourself before sleeping. And in the next coming programs, inshallah ta'ala, I will talk more about the different meals and when to eat those different meals, inshallah ta'ala. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. Ramadan Kareem.
In the limelight. Just 7 hours before prosecutors opened their case against Derek Chauvin, a former Minneapolis police officer charged with murdering George Floyd, a Chicago police officer chased down a 13-year-old teenage boy in a West Side alley and fatally shot him as he turned with his hands up. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists John Elligon and Sean Hubler. The piece is titled, Throughout Trial Over George Floyd's Death, Killings by Police Mount. Just 7 hours before prosecutors opened their case against Derek Chauvin, a former Minneapolis police officer charged with murdering George Floyd, a Chicago police officer chased down a 13-year-old teenage boy in a West Side alley and fatally shot him as he turned with his hands up. One day later, at a hotel in Jacksonville, Florida, police officers fatally shot a 32-year-old man who the police say grabbed one of their tasers. The day after that, as an eyewitness to Mr. Floyd's death broke down in a Minneapolis courtroom while recounting what he saw, a 40-year-old mentally ill man who said he was being harassed by voices was killed in Claremont, New Hampshire, in a shootout with the state police. On every day that followed, all the way through the close of testimony, another person was killed by the police somewhere in the United States. The trial has forced a traumatized country to relive the gruesome death of George Floyd beneath Derek Chauvin's knee. But even as Americans continue to process that case and anxiously wait for a verdict, new cases of people killed by the police mount unabated. Since testimony began on 29th of March, at least 64 people have died at the hands of law enforcement nationwide, with black and Latino people representing more than half of the dead. As of Saturday, the average was more than 3 killings a day. The deaths, culled by the New York Times from gun violence databases, new media accounts and law enforcement releases, offer a snapshot of policing in America at this moment. They testify not only to the danger and desperation that police officers confront daily, but also to the split-second choices and missteps by members of law enforcement that can escalate workaday arrests into fatalities. They are the result of domestic violence calls, traffic stops gone awry, standoffs and chases. The victims often behave erratically, some suffering from mental illness, and the sight of anything resembling a weapon causes things to escalate very quickly. And their fallout has been wrenchingly familiar, from the graphic videos that so often emerge to the protests that so often descend into scuffles between law enforcement and demonstrators on the streets of the United States, filled with tear gas. Just as one community confronts one killing, another killing happens. Across the spectrum, from community activists to law enforcement personnel, there is emotional and mental exhaustion, and a feeling that the nation cannot get this right. How many more losses must be mourned? Miski Noor, the co-executive director of the Minneapolis-based activist group Black Visions, said in a statement after the killing of Daunte Wright, a 20-year-old, during a recent traffic stop in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. "The pain of George Floyd's death is still scarred into our minds, and yet history continues to repeat itself," the statement continued. "Our community has reached its breaking point." This past week, the mayor of Chicago called for calm as excruciating body camera footage was released in the police killing of a 13-year-old teenager, Adam Toledo. The shaky video shows a police officer responding to a call of shots fired, chasing a boy with what appears to be a gun down an alley at night in a predominantly Latino neighborhood. "Stop right now," the police officer screams whilst cursing. "Hands, show me your hands, drop it, drop it." A single shot fells the boy as he turns, lifting his hands. Other recent lethal force incidents have rocked communities large and small. Michael Leon Hughes, a 32-year-old, a black man shot to death on 30th of March after the police said he used a taser on a Jacksonville police officer responding to a domestic dispute in a motel. I remember Sycap, a 16-year-old, a Pacific Islander, killed on 5th of April as he fled from the Honolulu police in a stolen Honda Civic. And Anthony Thompson Jr., a 17-year-old black teenager in Knoxville, Tennessee, killed by police on 12th of April in a high school bathroom after reports that a student had brought a gun onto the campus. All of those killings and many more occurred as testimony in the Minneapolis trial unfolded, though few attracted as much national attention as the shooting of Daunte Wright, less than 10 miles from the courthouse where Derek Chauvin stood trial. Protests erupted in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, after a veteran police officer fatally shot Daunte Wright, saying she mistook her gun for her taser as he attempted to flee during a traffic stop. Abigail Serra, a Minneapolis civil rights lawyer and member of the Minneapolis Police Conduct Oversight Commission, said it was unclear why the police officers stopped him for an expired registration, an issue for many drivers in the state during the coronavirus pandemic. But two aspects of the case, she said, were infuriatingly familiar: that Daunte Wright was black, and that the police tasked with delivering him safely to the courts of law where violations of the law are supposed to be adjudicated, effectively delivered a death sentence. It's just another example of a nothing offense escalated to lethality, Ms. Sarah said. Though many of these killings have a familiar ring, it is unfair to blame them all on law enforcement, said Patrick Yeoz, a retired sheriff's office captain and president of the National Fraternal Order of Police. In a lot of cities, it has to do with people feeling hopeless, he said. It's poverty, it's a failing education system, it's all of these things that are vitally important to stability of a community. That instability often places police officers in situations in which they confront individuals who may be dangerous and non-compliant, he said. Part of the reason society has been unable to prevent deadly encounters between law enforcement and the community is that some people are unwilling to discuss the real challenges of crime that police officers sometimes encounter, he said. There's just so many factors that people have already made up their minds, and they think that law enforcement is based off of race, Mr. Yeoz continued. Federal and state laws generally hold that police officers are justified in using lethal force as long as they have a reasonable fear of imminent injury or death for themselves or another person. And jurors tend not to second-guess what might be reasonable force in the moment. Of the 64 fatal encounters compiled by the New York Times for the past 3 weeks, at least 42 cases involve people accused of wielding firearms. More than a dozen involve confrontations with people who were mentally ill or in the throes of a breakdown. And at least 10 cases arose as the police responded to reports of domestic violence. Since at least 2013, with a slight dip because of the coronavirus pandemic, about 1,100 people have been killed each year by police officers, according to databases compiled by Mapping Police Violence, a research and advocacy group that examines all such killings, including non-gun-related deaths such as George Floyd's. The Washington Post, whose numbers are limited to police shootings, reflect a similarly flat trend line. Nearly all of the victims since 29th of March this year have been men, with black or Latino people substantially overrepresented, a pattern that reflects broader criminal justice research. And most were under the age of 30. Four were teenagers. Philip Stinson, a professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University who studies civilian killings by members of law enforcement, said the most striking aspect of the statistics on lethal police force is how little the numbers have changed over the last decade or two, since researchers began to comprehensively track them. Dr. Philip Stinson added, even as cell phone videos and body cameras make it harder to hide human error and abuses of authority by law enforcement, and even as social media amplifies public outrage, only about 1.1% of police officers who kill civilians are actually charged with murder or manslaughter.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed. Live in Hope.
Toward the Pig.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamadi. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon all our brothers and sisters. And our dear listeners, I hope you all are doing well and you're listening to the Youth Station only on IRIB English Radio. I'm Hasnain and we have...
Salaamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. I am Zainab. Thank you so much for being with us. So what are we talking about today?
Okay, we are talking about, you know, people pretending to be something that they're not. You know, why do people love... so much to pretend themselves to be
something. Is that really a bad thing, pretending to be something we're not? We pretend all the time.
Yeah, but why aren't you just real?
Because sometimes the real version of me is not necessarily suitable for the society. I'm not saying that the real version of me is a psychopath serial killer that goes around hunting down people for sheer joy and pleasure and ending their lives. God forbid, that's not the real me. But the real me could be a more preserved person, a more reserved person. A real me is less sociable. The real me is introverted. The real me could be, you know...
So don't you think that pretending to be something is like you just being fake?
No, I am being presentable. There is a difference. There's actually a hadith in Islam. There's a hadith that says a true believer reserves his sorrow in his heart and displays a smile on his face. That's contradictory. The dude is sad and miserable.
You're pretending to be good.
There's no problem there. You're pretending to be happy when you're miserable. A person could be depressed and miserable in real life, but when they go into the society, they're like a bubbly and smiley. They're not the real self. They're being totally fake. But okay, so I don't see
what
anyone.
What was the problem being the real self?
Society won't accept it. Number one.
Okay, let me ask. Like, okay, you're saying that people pretend they hide their real self. What if they make their real self the thing that they are pretending to be?
Yeah, it depends on what the real self is. You know, that real self could be someone who is depressed, for example, right? Yeah. I'm going to talk about depression because this sort of double life, this sort of duplicity in personality is more noticeable in those who suffer from some sort of mental illness, right? Because of the stigma that exists within society or just because they don't want to put other
people... So do you think that's good, you know, just getting so much dissolved into the society so that, you know, there's a person that he might be a middle class, so but just so that the society won't accept him, they'll think bad about him, so he'll just carry himself in such a way that he's not rich, he'll just pretend to be rich so that people should accept him in the society. Do you think that's good?
To a degree, I don't see a problem with it. I mean, obviously, who I am in my private life is different from who I am in society. And I don't see why is it necessary for me to display my private side in society to begin with. Why? You tell me why I shouldn't pretend, I'll tell you.
But yeah, but this thing pressurizes the people, you know.
To do what?
To do what? Like, you know, if someone's a middle class, how can he live between the people who are... you know, not the same match.
Don't go live with between the people who are not the same with you. You're middle class. Go and be friends with middle class people, so you wouldn't have to pretend.
Yeah, that's why you're creating differences between the people.
But there already are differences. I'm not creating it. It exists.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when someone's pretending to be something, so there's a reason behind it.
What's the reason?
Yeah, that's why this middle class guy pretending to be rich because the society doesn't accept him.
Which it depends on the society again. if he lives among, suppose I'm a middle class woman, right? Uh-huh. If I, all my friends are middle class like me, would I have a reason to pretend that I'm rich? Who am I trying to impress? We're all the same.
You're living in a society where you find middle class, like below average class, and rich people, like everyone. It's a society. So over there, between the people, so you carry yourself in such a way so that you should look rich.
You know, it's just you're
trying to be fake. You know, why can't be your real self? So that's what, now you say that you should don't live between the people. So it's creating differences between the people. You know, that actually there shouldn't be any problem of you living with that, the rich people. And rich people shouldn't have any problem accepting the people who are middle class or lower than themselves.
Right. And then what sort of objective would they gain through this? What objective would people gain from being themselves in society, not pretending, per se? So, like, everyone...
The real self.
And then what?
You know, okay, so it's... everyone cannot pretend, right? Like, you also need something to pretend. So, you'll be comfortable when you're your real self. Mm. You don't have to pretend.
Right, right. So, you're more comfortable with... but have you heard them saying... that goes, fake it until you make it?
Depends upon what...
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to figure out. Like, because there are certain contexts where a person is meant to carry themselves just a bit above what they really are in order to help them get closer to their objective, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, pretending might be in different aspects.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so this was like, you know... like social and economic aspect of pretending. Okay, like what about people who are not good, like ill-mannered people? You know, they're trying to be, you know, pretending to be good. Or what do you think about that? Like, as in munafiq, what do you think about that?
Like
munafiq is all about pretending, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Is that good?
Yeah, I think that's what makes the whole concept of pretending a bit scary, because there's that fine line. How long can you pretend until you actually turn into someone who's hollow and fake and totally unreal and is untrustworthy and is constantly lying? And that's where the term munafiq pops up in Islamic terminology, which means hypocrites. Those who pretend to be something that they're not.
What I wanted to say was that pretending everywhere is not bad. Like, you broke from inside, you're sad, but still you're keeping yourself happy from the outside.
Mm.
So over here, you pretend it's not a problem. That's good, actually.
Mm.
But, like, being a hypocrite,
yeah,
that's dangerous. You know, that's what happens. You know, someone pretending to be a Muslim, someone pretending to be a scholar, but actually he's not. He's the devil. He's just pretending to be a scholar, and he's spreading fuss between the people. Like, he's spreading hate between the people.
Exactly.
What do you think about this pretending?
Obviously, in that, the objective behind it is a corrupted, ill, sick objective. Mm-hmm. It's malicious, and it's evil, straight up evil, right?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, in such a context, pretending is poisonous.
Mm-hmm.
And it will destroy that person, it will destroy the society. In Islam, I think Islam as a religion has faced more damage and harm
because of the
from the area of the hypocrites than it has done from the disbelievers.
Exactly.
Tell where the hypocrite is standing, you know? On the outside, they pretend, quote-unquote, to be your friend, like the Quran says, and they, when you're going to war, they would tell you, oh, but if we could, we would totally come with you.
Yeah.
Our hearts are with you. We support you in spirit.
What they do is they stab you from
the back.
From the back.
Exactly. And it's a very dishonest. Yeah. I mean, at least a believer stabs you in the front. And you know that the person, you know, has beef with you. They don't like you. But with a munafiq or a hypocrite, they pretend to like you.
Yeah.
But just when you let your guard down.
Okay, what about someone, you know, pretending to be knowledgeable? Like, what do you think?
That's the most horrible.
Yeah, if I'm not a doctor,
mm.
and I pretend to be a doctor, and if I operate any patient,
They'll die.
You know, I'll not cure him. He'll die. The patient will die. The poor guy will die.
That's horrible. I think pretending to know is one of the worst kinds of pretending. I mean, at least you can pretend to be rich because, you know, you don't want to look down upon in society, mm-hmm. especially when it's based on something so materialistic and superficial, you know? But when you pretend to be knowledgeable, you will end up proving yourself otherwise, trying to prove yourself to be knowledgeable, you know, because it comes through your speech. When you pretend to know about something and then you express a thought about it, for a person who does know about something, they'll be able to tell and call you out on your BS and be like, but you don't even know what you're talking about. Right? Okay, that's embarrassing.
Yeah, when I was saying that, you know, pretending something is like you're being fake, I meant that, you know, you're pretending to be something. Okay, you're pretending to be rich, you're pretending to be a doctor. But deep inside, you know that you're not that thing. You're not so-and-so. So what do you think about that?
It's illegal. I think it's illegal. And people shouldn't do that. And they can...
People should be fined for that.
Yeah, they are fined and arrested for that, too. And if you end up killing a person, you're charged with manslaughter. Mm-hmm. And you either get executed or you have to do time for life. And officially, your life... The one, whether the real one or the one you pretended to have, are both over. And at the end of the day, I think we have to talk about why, the reason why people find the need within themselves to pretend. Yeah. Especially with social media.
I guess to fit themselves in that situation.
Exactly. To fit in, right? People pretend so that they can fit in.
What about munafiqat, hypocrisy?
Oh, those people, they pretend so that they can gain some benefits. Right? Sometimes pretending has much more innocent motifs behind it. Mm-hmm. A person just wants to have a sense of belonging. A person wants to be accepted by the people around them.
Yeah.
Maybe they won't benefit from that.
No, wait, before saying that, please tell me, are there any pros or the good side of pretending? What do you think?
Or as a person who suffers from crippling social anxiety, I find that pretending in certain situations has helped me a lot because I go into a crowd and to a meeting with a bunch of strangers, people that I don't know, a room filled with other human beings. It's less now that it's, you know, we're living in a pandemic, which is another reason why I've been loving coronavirus. Mm-hmm. My heart goes out to those who've suffered from this virus anyway. Mm-hmm. But if I sort of sit in that pool of anxiousness and, oh God, I don't want to be here. Oh God, I don't want to be here. Mm-hmm. It will slowly be noticeable on my face and I'll start sweating and I'll start shivering. Everyone will start saying, oh my God, Ms. Zainab, are you okay? Mm-hmm. Are you uncomfortable? Are you sick? I'll go pale and this and that. But I pretend. I don't want to be here. My heart is racing. I hate all of you. No, nothing personal because I'm suffering, right? But I pretend to put on a smile. I pretend to nod my head, even though I'm not even listening.
So yeah, over here, pretending is good. Like when you're in any problem, or like you're in troubles or difficulties, so you don't show it to the people. Mm. You still pretend to be good. You pretend to be normal. So that's good over here. So as our golden words say, every coin has two sides.
Yeah.
So the good side might be this of pretending, but the bad side is pretending sometimes leads to destruction.
Exactly.
Like as we said, like someone pretending to be a doctor and the hypocrites.
Yeah.
You know, hypocrites, they create division, you know, in the religion.
Mm. No, and that's the worst thing. Even. Yeah. In hypocrites the society, yeah. In everything, you know. There are hypocrites in relationships, there are hypocrites in a household, hypocrites in politics. Yeah. And it's sad, and we need to...
You know, hypocrites are the worst. They're worse than the open enemies.
Mm, exactly. They're like parasites that eat Joe.
Well,
that's all the time we have for today's episode.
Okay, thank you so much, dear audience, for staying with us. And thank you so much, Sister Zainab. It was really good to talk with you.
Thank you, likewise.
And until the next show, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. To have a precious love in my life.
inside. I wish that everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and made me strong.
What Biden did not admit is that the United States and its allies, with all their money and firepower, were unable to vanquish the Taliban, who currently control about half of Afghanistan and are positioned to control even more in the coming month without a ceasefire, says Jessica Corbett Ryder in an article published under the heading, As Biden Plans Withdrawal, Analysis Shows Afghan War Cost at Least 241,000 Lives and $2.26 Trillion. Stay tuned for the details, please. In the wake of President Joe Biden's announcement that he plans to withdraw all regular U.S. combat troops from Afghanistan by this year's anniversary of September 11, 2001 attacks, experts at the Cost of War Project recently released an update on what nearly two decades of war has cost in both dollars and human lives. An estimated 241,000 people have died as a direct result of the war, and the United States has spent $2.26 trillion in military operations in Afghanistan and Pakistan since 2001 U.S. invasion, according to the project housed at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs and Boston University's Frederick S. Paradis Center for the study of the longer-range future. These horrific numbers are testament to the cost of war, first to the Afghan people and then to the troops and people of the United States, said project co-director and Brown University professor Catherine Lutz in a statement. Ending the war as soon as possible is the only rational and human thing to do, it added. The new Cost of War Project figures are part of a nearly decade-long effort by co-director and Boston University professor Nita Crawford to track the cost of post-9/11 wars in not only Afghanistan and Pakistan, but also Iraq, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, and beyond. The death tally includes U.S. military and contractors, Department of Defense civilians, Afghan and Pakistani national military and police, other allied troops, civilians, opposition fighters, journalists, and media workers and humanitarian aid workers. The project notes that these figures do not include deaths caused by disease, loss of access to food, water, infrastructure, and/or other indirect consequences of the war. The financial costs include overseas contingency operations budgets of the U.S. Defense and State Departments, the DOD's base budget war-related increases, veteran care, and estimated interest on money borrowed to fund the war. It does not include future cost of veteran care or future interest payments. The DOD spending at over $900 billion in Afghanistan is a tip of the iceberg, Crawford said. The costs of the Afghanistan war include its escalation into Pakistan, millions of refugees and displaced persons, the toll in lives of combatants and non-combatants, and the need to care for America's veterans. The Pentagon's base budget has increased as well. Report these estimates so that the American people will have a better understanding of the scale of the effort and its consequences, she explained. The American people also lost some transparency here. A more comprehensive accounting is yet to be completed. It would include not just money that may or may not have been well spent, but the count of those wounded, those who lost limbs, and the tremendous psychological toll of decades of war on combatants and non-combatants and their families. The new numbers come after Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Ro Khanna argued recently in an op-ed for the Washington Post that the withdrawal should spark a reflection upon the enormous costs of nearly two decades of war and enable the U.S. to refocus on diplomacy as U.S. foreign policy tool of first resort. Executing a responsible and comprehensive withdrawal from Afghanistan is an essential first step toward Biden fulfilling his commitment to end forever wars, the lawmakers wrote. What Biden did not admit is that the United States and its allies, with all their money and firepower, were unable to vanquish the Taliban, who currently control about half of Afghanistan and are positioned to control even more in the coming month without a ceasefire. Nor did Biden admit that, in two decades, the United States and its allies have been unable to build up a stable, democratic, popular government or a competent military in the country. Benjamin and Davis activists also noted that while Biden is being pilloried by some for pulling out too soon, the truth is that he is violating a May 1st deadline for U.S. troops withdrawal that was painstakingly negotiated under the Trump administration. And anticipation of that U.S. violation has prompted the Taliban to refuse to join 10 days of United Nations-led peace talks set to start in Istanbul on April 24th. We must hope that in the coming months the U.N. will find a way to bring the warring parties in Afghanistan together and craft a ceasefire and a workable peace process based on power sharing, they concluded. After so many decades of war and intense suffering, much of it perpetrated by United States and its allies, the Afghan people desperately need and deserve an end to this war.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics.
all produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on the blessed month of Ramadan.
Some of the characteristics of the month of Ramadan. Certain characteristics of the month of Ramadan have been mentioned in the du'as recorded in Sahih al-Sajjadiyah or other books. The month of Ramadan has been referred to as the month of penitence and the month of surrender, which is in Sahih al-Sajjadiyah. The meaning of surrender is identical to that of the word submit in the ayah. And whoever submits himself wholly to Allah and He is the doer of good to others, he indeed has taken hold of the firmest thing upon which one can lay hold. The Holy Quran, chapter 31, verse 22. Whoever submits himself wholly to Allah means surrendering one's heart and soul and making them submissive to divine will, divine orders and sharia. Ramadan has also been referred to as the month of purification, which means that Ramadan contains a quality that purifies people from impurities. When an impure precious metal like gold is placed inside a furnace, it is purified. Purification means purifying human soul of impurities.
فيك الحب زاد عم العباد يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان
People benefit from speaking to Allah the Exalted during Ramadan. People benefit from speaking to Allah the Exalted, being addressed by Him, praying to Him and opening up their hearts to Him. They do these by reading the prayers of the month of Ramadan, reading the Abu Hamza al-Thumali dua and the du'as that one reads during the days, nights and early mornings of Ramadan are actually a kind of speaking to God, making requests from God and getting close to God. These people benefit from these things too. Therefore, they benefit from all the blessings of the celebration. Avoiding sins is of higher priority and perhaps it is more important than these du'as in some ways. These people do not commit sin in this month either. In the same sermon, which was delivered by the Holy Prophet ﷺ and the Commander of Faithful ﷺ, asked the Holy Prophet, which act is the most blessed act? The Holy Prophet ﷺ answers, avoiding sins. Avoiding sins is of higher priority than Islamic obligations. It prevents one heart and soul from corruption.
To Allah.
around the world with reporters.
Exchanging accusations, disagreements, and threats. This is how Turkey and Greece's relation has been going for decades, and it seems that this is how it will continue, despite the trials to solve the problems through dialogue. The two countries have always been at loggerheads due to several factors, such as history, disputes on border, politics, culture, and lately, interests and power. Not to mention the refugee crisis, which added to the pile of disputes, as well as the latest maritime conflict. During a visit that is the first since the heated dispute that rose in 2020 between the two neighbors over Turkey sending a search vessel into East Mediterranean, foreign ministers of both countries exchanged accusations. The press conference started with a welcoming speech for Turkish foreign minister to holding this dialogue in hope to search solutions for the differences between Ankara and Athens. However, the Greek minister took advantage of this opportunity to criticize Turkey's actions in Eastern Mediterranean and accuse Ankara of not abiding by the refugee deal made with Brussels, which forced Mevlut Çavuşoğlu to respond.
If you heavily accuse my country and people before the press, I have to be in a position to respond to that. If you want to continue our tensions, we can. If we go into mutual recriminations here, we have a lot to tell each other.
For his turn, Nikos Dendias, the Greek foreign minister, accused Turkey of not abiding by the deal made in 2016 with the EU, adding Turkey should not try to teach Greece lessons.
What's happened during the press conference after the meeting between Turkish and Greek foreign ministers was very unfortunate, but this is the actual illustration of the relation between the two. Many believe that there is no chance for reaching a solution. Today, a meeting between Cyprus, Greece, Israel and the UAE will take place. However, Egypt won't participate in this meeting. Turkey won't hesitate to respond if the outcome of this meeting wasn't up to Ankara's expectations, and I don't think the response will only be verbal.
In 2020, Turkey showed goodwill by pulling its search vessel Eurotrace from Eastern Mediterranean in hope that dialogue between Ankara and Athens would reach a common ground. The conflict between Turkey and Greece is too profound to be solved in few meetings. Analysts believe the two must put those differences aside if they plan to reach a solution, or else the conflict will worsen. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
There is no letter to the protest to compel Pakistani government to expel French ambassador from the country. At the heart of current wave of angry protest is government's decision to shelve its 5 months old agreement with Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan or TLP, a religious and political party, to expel the French ambassador to Islamabad. The repeated incidents of publications of blasphemous cartoons of Islam's Prophet Muhammad and official patronage of France to unending incident of blasphemy has once again triggered a mass unrest in Pakistan starting early this week. The security forces came down hard onto the protesters and managed to clear most of the highways they had occupied across Pakistan few days ago. Paris has advised all of its citizens to immediately leave Pakistan over security concern to their lives. Pakistan has restored services of major platforms on social media networks after temporarily suspending them to contain the violence. The religious group claims that over two dozens of its supporters were killed by security forces while hundreds of others were injured and arrested. The government says nearly 600 of its policemen were injured and four of them were killed in the clashes.